I very rarely on Gracias a la Vida get to interview people, and in this case we're playing a little pre-recorded interview with two poets and translators who have been working with the book Las Poemas de Vikram Babu, written by Jesús Aguado in 2001, and their translation is The Poems of Vikram Babu that came out in 2009. I welcome Electa and, shall I say B or Beatrix?
B is fine.
B. That's Electa Arenal and Beatrix Gates. So welcome to Gracias a la Vida. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Jim.
I thought it would be fun to start, just go right into it and read one of the poems. I gather you're going to read it in English and then in Spanish, and then we'll talk about it.
Right. I was just going to add that Jesús Aguado is a contemporary Spanish poet. He spent 6 years in Benares in India and was inspired to invent a character named Vikram Babu. Vikram Babu is a Hindu basket weaver from the 17th century who tells ironic stories, fable-like in form, and always asks the reader a question at the end. So here we go from Jesús Aguado's The Poems of Vikram Babu. Like the king who builds a glass palace, the walls, the rooms, transparent. There are no secrets. Everything can be seen by everyone. It began as a game, but the king becomes uncomfortable, and instead of closing the palace off with curtains, interior walls, or anything at all, he orders his subjects' eyes gouged out. Vikram Babu asks, "Are you like that?"
Como el rey que construye un palacio de vidrio, los muros, las estancias transparentes, no hay secretos, pues todo está bien a la vista para todos. Y al principio era un juego, pero luego el rey se siente incómodo y en vez de hacerlo opaco con cortinas o muros interiores, cualquier cosa, ordena vaciar los ojos de sus súbditos. Vikram Babu pregunta, ¿eres así?
What inspired you to translate these poems?
Good question. we are both literature people. I more have been a student of literature
a scholar of literature.
A scholar of literature, indeed. And I also met Jesús Aguado, who was a friend of another poet friend, Lola Luna, from Sevilla. And they were just extraordinary, both in their personalities, friends. And we talked poetry and got to be interested in each other's work and lives. And then when this book came out, I thought it was a marvelous book, and we were able to get together around the translation.
Well, I just was going to say that the fact that Electa knew Jesus as a young man, as a young poet, and was very excited about his work. From there, when she said, how about doing some translations, he said, could you start with this book, The Poems of Vikram Babu? He really wanted this book translated. And we had agreed to take it on as both a challenge and as something fun that we could do together. So Electa said to me, if it's not fun, we don't have to do it. And on that basis, I agreed.
Before we go any further, I want to be sure we get a chance to talk about a program you're giving Sunday night at the Cannery in Penobscot, which is 207 South Bay Road in Penobscot, a fascinating place for avant-garde music and now poetry. What will you be doing?
Well, we're not going to give away everything we're doing. But this is the beginning of a series called Sidelines in Translation, which I have decided to run with. And I thought of Electa immediately. And when she said she was coming up here, I said, hey, let's do a program. So this is the inaugural program of the Sidelines in Translation series. And we're going to be featuring, obviously, the poems of Vikram Babu. I feel it's important to say that we're going for how to bring other cultures into this place in Maine, and that the infusion of more than one culture is incredibly important. So the poems bring us a way to not only hear different languages, but to explore levels of meaning from India, from Spain, from this country, from traditions of oral history through the poem. So there are many levels it can work on. But the Sidelines series will be bringing work in translation to the cannery. And sometimes translation will not be necessarily language to language. So, for example, in June, we're going to have Poetry and Masks as the in translation series.
And Alecta, you've done other poetry readings. Have you done readings from this book in other places?
Yes, I haven't listed them, so I won't dare to try to recall. But
I think I saw something about Santa Fe.
Yes, that's right. We were down there, did a residency, and also gave reading down in Santa Fe. I also work on the Shakespeare of Latin America, who happens to have been a 17th century woman named Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. Hmm. Who was lived in, as I said, in the first half of the 17th century. Extraordinary character who's on the 200 peso bill. In fact, I once, when Washington gave a lecture called Sor Juana, Why She's on the Money.
Good turn of phrase. Yeah. Why don't we hear another poem, whichever one you like, and then we'll talk about the structure of the poem a little bit more.
The next one that we agreed to read is called Like the One Who Crosses a Bridge. And you'll notice that all the poems begin with Like the One Who. Like the one who crosses a bridge, avoiding the middle, balancing like a tightrope walker on the railings. The river roars below. Crocodiles crack their jaws, grind their teeth. The bridge sways in the wind. The planks creak from the excess weight of the people crossing. Used to his craziness, they've stopped paying attention. From this shore to the other shore, everyone is doing the same thing. Vikram Babu asks, are they?
Como el que cruza un puente, pero no por el centro, haciendo equilibrismos por una barandilla. El río ruge abajo, los cocodrilos hacen chasquear sus mandíbulas. El viento mueve el puente y crujen las maderas por el peso excesivo de los hombres que pasan. Acostumbrados, nadie repara ya en el loco. De una orilla a otra orilla, todos hacen lo mismo. Vikram Babu pregunta, ¿todos hacen lo mismo?
Was he a fluent Hindi speaker?
Jesus has said that he was not thinking in Hindi, and that his experience in Benares is about being in a place where life is on the edge, and that you don't need to speak any language when you're there. You can be there silently for months. He was there for a number of years and has traveled extensively back and forth and stayed there. And for him, it was, as a poet, to be a vessel, to absorb meanings, multi-layers and multi-sensual meanings, atmosphere, tone, language, the ways that life occurs, the ways that death occurs. We're very focused, unfortunately, in some ways, on life, how perfect our lives are. And obviously, in Benares, that's not the focus. It has this edge of life and death, both being omnipresent. He's most alive in Benares. He loves being in that place of in-between, and also marked life, death, all the time, and the ways that people are dealing with that.
Or at least then, I think. I mean, it was his India period, you know, and then he went back to Spain. And, but there he was exactly what he says, absorbed in the culture and exploring and expressing and experimenting and so on and really trying to feel it.
His poems do have an edginess to them. Mm-hmm. The first one you read, Gouging Eyes and Cocodrillos, the Crocodile.
He's an editor and an anthologist, and he worked putting together a volume of devotional verse from across time in India to be translated into Spanish. So he was infusing himself with those traditions. Mm-hmm. And that's how Vikram Babu kind of popped out. He said he began writing these poems in this voice of Vikram Babu, and it kept going. So it was through that study that he came to it, or it came to him. But that's one way. And then there's a whole other conversation about the ways that we actually translate together.
I'll just go right into that. I'm into reading the poems, and almost like a prose translation, you know, a direct translation. And then B would work on it. And then we would go back and forth, forming or reforming, you know, the poem in English.
One thing that's interesting is we evolved. The first time we sat down together, we tried to translate a poem beginning to end sitting next to each other, and it was impossible because there's so many levels of meaning. So we were arguing and fighting, and we like arguing about words, but it was not going to work. So we went to the, here's the literal, then I would go literally under the door, another room. I made versions under the door, back to her. She put things in parentheses, back to me. It'd be like 10, 12 times. And then we'd sit down together and have a marvelous conversation.
Yeah, I and maybe the next poem you can point out some of these things where you don't literally translate. You're translating, you have to deal with idiomatic expressions, with colloquial terms, but you're also, different languages have, a word can mean more than just the word's symbolic meaning. There's some other analogies that come out of that word. And all of his poems are kind of analogies and similes in that way. I guess I had in mind that maybe we could hear another one that spoke to Benares, and I think you had one in mind.
What we call the toothless man. Like an old toothless man who eats chickpeas without first softening and mashing them. So impatient and clumsy that he dies. So blind with complaints that he cooks his own death and not his life. And it turns out perfectly. Vikram Babu asks, do you recognize yourself?
Como un viejo sin dientes que comiera garbanzos sin haberlos ablandado con agua y luego hecho puré. Tan impaciente y torpe que se muere. Tan achacoso y ciego que cocina su muerte y no su vida. Y le sale en su punto. Vikram Babu pregunta, ¿eres así?
There are many, many levels of dark humor, exaggeration, something very dramatic but almost comical, quite extraordinary presentation, and yet something, it has something very much of the both the Indian and the Hispanic culture.
How would you define that, Electa?
Well, there's the edge of satirical tragedy, or satire and tragedy at the same time, of seriousness and comicity, of social concern, but turned in at a slant.
The idea that your death could be perfect is also a new concept for Westerners, I think.
So is the chickpea a metaphor for something else?
Well, you know what they're like if you try to eat chickpeas without having them soft. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a fun experience.
Especially if you have no teeth.
That makes it even worse. Something that's every day, and yet he's so impatient, he's probably cooked them a million times, he can't. He's just too impatient. And what does that mean? Plus he has no teeth. So he sets it up as already these two things are absurdities, and yet they're very direct daily kinds of evocations, and then also that he complains all the time, and that he can't see what he's doing, and life and death are right there, and he doesn't get it, and then he gets it. He dies perfectly. Yeah,
perfectly. That's the irony of this whole story. It sounds like somebody who's going to die in misery, but it's a perfect ending.
Yeah. And as I said, you know, for Mexico too, there's always, you know, this laughing about death and the whole calavera tradition that, which I think had its connection with Spain, too. There's something that,
well, let's hear another one.
Like the one who knots rugs. Like the one who knots rugs, and one day, for an instant, fails to pay attention. And when he comes to, he is part of the carpet. He is woven in under a branch of the tree of life. Prisoner in the weave and woof of a rug because of a moment's carelessness. And the rest of the world will no doubt praise the carpet until it comes threadbare, worn out, reduced to nothing. Vikram Babu asks, are you mindful?
Como el que anuda alfombras y un instante de un día se descentra y cuando vuelve en sí
ya forma parte de la alfombra, está entretejido en ella, debajo de una rama del árbol de la vida, prisionero en la trama de una alfombra por un descuido tonto. Y el resto de la gente alabará sin duda el resultado, mas sin duda también le pisarán hasta que se desgaste, se deshilache y quede a nada reducido. Vikram Babu pregunta, ¿estás atento?
What is he saying?
I think there's a wonderful relationship here between someone's daily practice and he's stops paying attention and he gets woven into the carpet. On the other hand, he's woven into the tree of life. So he thinks he's separate, but guess what? He's part of everything. He's a prisoner, but he is part of the rug because he didn't pay attention for 1 second. Meanwhile, the rest of the world looks at it and says, oh, how magnificent, this gorgeous rug. And then eventually the rug, too, falls away threadbare to nothing. So you have this idea that the one is not important, but is part of something whole. And that you too will become nothing, but you are part of something larger than yourself. So that's what I think of. And then are you mindful, that overused word at this point in time?
Yeah, I was going to say, estás atento. It could be translated in other ways, but are you
We
mindful?
Did that at that moment. And when I think of it now, I would use something else. How about you, Electa? We have that problem with words that should be put in the freezer for a while.
But, I grew up with it in, different meaning.
Estás atento.
Being mind, be mindful.
Yeah.
But I also think of it as a Dali-esque poem.
See that, yeah.
You're sort of very surrealistic, an invention that has an artistic quality about it, because these rugs do. And so, in some way, a very surreal picture.
I think of realismo mágico.
That's right.
This idea that you start with a real character, but it becomes less and less credible as you go along, something that's more imaginative, magic.
That's a great way to talk about it.
Yeah.
Do you have something else to say about that, about Mexican literature, Electa? Think of Juan Rulfo, or
so
I don't know.
So many of the writers.
But these people may not know, so why not mention a few, if you can think of some.
Well, I think of Gabriel
Garcia Marquez.
I was living for a year in Aracataca, Colombia, where he was born and was Macondo. Yes. In 100 Years of Solitude.
Right. Mm.
But there are many other Latin writers who use that same technique of something that's very real, but then it's magical. It's not.
That's right.
It's not all planted on the ground.
That's right.
Yeah. I was just going to say the best metaphors are based in reality. That's why they work. So when you say something is like something else and it rings a bell, it's because we know that. Even if you've never thought of it before, you suddenly know it. It's clear to you.
Uh-huh.
So like the one is a simile, technically, but that's the point. You cut through in a way that people get the meaning in a different way.
But then there's also that wonderful sort of going into a totally different reality with an object, like a rug, like in a carpet, and so on. So there's this magic about it that's quite extraordinary.
There must be times in your process, even slipping notes under the door back and forth when you're translating, that you just can't figure out how to get an idea across. And how do you resolve that? Have you gotten to a point where you're going, well, this is the literal translation, but that doesn't convey the meaning, or it doesn't work in English?
There's certainly unique problems at times. We always start with the literal, and both of us believe very much in representing the poet, their tone, their voice, not writing some other thing, which some translators do, but neither one of us believes in that. It's really not fair to the poem or the poet. So the literal is a good place to start. And then how do you imagine the language that will carry it that has the equal tautness? Jesus's language is very simple, but it's complicated, the meaning. So how do you create that tightness and yet lean and carving through? So sometimes we would be, oh my God, what are we going to do? And we usually took a walk. Did we put it down for a while? We take a walk and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because it's very much, we're translating together very intensely, every day. So you take a walk, no paper, no pencil, nothing, and then the lector will say, oh, how about...
You need to let it rest or cook or either warm up or cool down, depending on what the problem is. The whole business of working on various different levels of the emotion and the exotic, in a sense, you know, the same culture, but a different culture, and going between cultures.
One of the things Electa taught me was that sometimes there will be alliteration in Spanish that cannot be duplicated in English with the same letter, you know. So what are you going to do? And she said, well, one thing you can do is take it and in English create alliteration with a different sound, but you are still creating alliteration, which will create a certain kind of mood. And I thought, oh, well, that is really cool. What a good idea. We read the bridge poem, but I was just going to say, in that instance with the bridge poem, there is this place where the river roars below. Crocodiles crack their jaws, grind their teeth. Now, in Spanish, on page 64...
El río ruge abajo. Los cocodrilos hacen chasquear sus mandíbulas. El viento mueve el puente. So the crocodiles are...
grinding.
Exactly, grinding, chasquear. But that word is, you know, does it, chasquear. Yeah. And the mandíbulas, also the jaw.
So we came up with the crocodile's crack, you know, as some way to, you know, begin to approach it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, the alliteration.
That's exactly. Sort of... That's what I wanted to point out, that we found a way. It's not the same, but it's something. It's a gesture towards what happened in the poem.
A lot to keep in mind.
Yes, and then each time that we translate together and go back and forth, we address another level. Well, that works on this level, but not that one.
Yeah. So let's hear one more.
Okay. We would like to end with this poem called Like the One Who Goes to a Wedding. Like the one who goes to a wedding so filthy that he is thrown out and tries to get in through another door. And the dogs bark at him, and he tears the tent canvas, and it takes several people to get hold of him and toss him flying into the bathroom, where he tries to dig a tunnel, and the rats bite his ears. Anything not to clean up, put on other clothes, a scent of sandalwood, perhaps, oil on his hair, a flower, simple things. Especially considering it was his own wedding. Vikram Babu asks, who wants to get married?
Como el que va a una boda tan sucio que le expulsan y prueba en otra puerta y le azuzan los perros y desgarra la lona de la tienda y entre varios le atrapan y le arrojan volando a las letrinas y prueba a hacer un túnel y las ratas le muerden las orejas. Todo en vez de asearse, de ponerse otras ropas, quizás algo de sándalo y aceite para el pelo, o una guirnalda, cosas sencillas, sobre todo si tenemos en cuenta que era su propia boda. Vikram Babu pregunta, ¿quién se casa? It could be, ¿quién se casa?
Vestido así, por lo menos. Yes. What is it? I mean, there's a broader context here. Someone's arriving at his own wedding and not ready, not treating it seriously.
It's a kind of this poem that each time and over the years I've thought of it in very many different ways, because it's full of stuff from countries like Mexico and like India and like, you know, where there are these extremes of filth and cleanliness, of rich and poor, of customs that come from way, way back and new. And it has a tremendous surrealist, you know, element about it, of course. And takes it all the way to such exaggeration that it becomes ridiculous in some sense.
I think that's why people laugh, you know, because it becomes so ridiculous. And yet it does challenge, you know, significance of rules and opprobrium. And even I, for the first time today, when we were reading it aloud again in the kitchen, I thought, well, you know, in terms of arranged marriage, when it's discussed, many people assume that it's the woman who doesn't agree or not agree. It just happens. But in fact, that's not really true.
The either, yeah. It's the parents who
make the parents who make the arrangements. So, you know, in this case, perhaps he was not that interested in going, but
he's forced into it. So I never thought of that. It's so obvious. I mean, that's just one layer, but it also has its own way of arriving through this craziness, the rat's biting his ears. I mean, that's extreme, right? Crawling away, trying to crawl away, anything not to get in there. And then we discussed the ending a lot. Who's getting married or who wants to get married?
Yeah.
And we ended up going for the who wants to get married.
I imagine some of our listeners would like to read more of these poems. Where can they get your book?
You can get it at Blue Hill Books. They have it. And also the publisher is Host Publications in Austin, Texas. And they are online. You can get books through Host. And then there's also a bookstore in Austin, Texas, run by the publisher called Malvern, M-A-L-V-E-R-N, Books. Joe Bratcher is the publisher and the proprietor of this wonderful bookstore. So you can always call Malvern or call Host and order books. Or and through your local bookstore, you can do that too. In this case, Blue Hill Books.
And you have a website, which people may also find easier to remember. So what's your website?
It's pretty easy. Let's hope I can remember it. It's BeatrixGates.com. BeatrixGates.com.
So if they can Google the book, they'll find it probably in a bunch of online resources.
All the
too.
Books are on that website with instructions about how to order.
Great. Well, do you have any other closing thoughts?
Well, we've talked about just the importance of uniting various different worlds through translation. I mean, without translation, there's so much we wouldn't have. We were talking the other day, people who think, oh, well, what do I need that for? You know, what about Homer? What about Gilgamesh? You know, the oldest story in the world come from what is now Iran, which has been translated by 5 or 6 different people. So what happens when you bring work from another time or place to hearers in another time and place, and you're making accessible and clear all kinds of different experiences and cultures? Some might be violent, some might be sweet, but you are actually allowing yourself into a different kind of experience of the world. And Electa has done far more translating than I have. She's translated North American poets to Spanish, like Adrienne Rich. She's translated Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegría into English. She's translated Sor Juana and traveled literally all over the world talking about Sor Juana. So you may have more to say on this.
Oh, I think you've actually said it all quite well. In some way, life is translation, right? Because we're always translating one mode into another, and each other's words, even how people understand the same language very often. There are games you can play with seeing how differently people hear things and convey them or repeat them. But I think also the fact that we are so close to so many Spanish-speaking countries means that, you know, it's very important for Americans to be able to deal with the bilingualism of